With our very special guest tonight, Dr. Sam Parnia, as we talk about what happens when we die, an incredible research study, his book, of course, by that title as well. And we'll be back with more and you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Sam, we haven't got into resuscitation science yet. Explain that for me.
Well, resuscitation science is actually a relatively new area in medicine. In fact, it's celebrating its 50th anniversary now. And it was essentially the discovery, although for, I guess, from the beginning of time, as far as we can see, at least the last few thousand years that we have history of, people have tried to revive the dead, but usually unsuccessfully. So historically, life was associated with warmth. And so at the time of the Greek physician Galen, people used to, for example, try to heat the dead, either by just heating them in any way they could, and sometimes even using burning excrement on dead bodies, trying to revive them. And essentially, various other measures have been put into effect without success, such as using a bellows in Europe around the 16th, 17th centuries. But it was only essentially about 50, 60 years ago that people realized that we could try to restart the heart after it has stopped. And that eventually led to the idea of CPR. And using drugs to try to get a patient who's died to have a blood pressure and try to restart the heart and then shock the heart, as we talked about. And what's incredible is that although we still are not as successful as we'd like to be, we could only revive around, say, 10 to 15% of people who've died in a hospital, bring them back to life again. But at least we have some success, whereas before we had none. And so I think this is a very important field because we have, through resuscitation science, managed to overcome what was thought to always be the impossible, which is to bring people back to life after they have died. And through that, we're able to study what happens not only to the brain, but also to the mind and consciousness in people who have died. And I think it is a growing field, and it is one that will provide answers to some of our deepest philosophical questions. In other words, what happens when we die? What is the nature of the human mind and consciousness, the soul, etc.?
Let's talk a little bit more about the soul, Doctor. What do you think it is?
Well, because of my research in this field, I've had to look back and try to understand at least what people mean by it, because it is a term that's used a lot.
Yes.
In the common language, it's often synonymous with spirit, soul. People use them, and then people talk about things like ghosts. And, you know, it's difficult, really, to know, at least scientifically, what we're talking about. What I have found, at least scholars have found, is that it is thought that early civilizations, say 4,000 or 5,000 years ago at least, seem to have thought that there may be a duplicate of the individual. And this they called the soul. And it may be that they found that this to be the case because of dreams, encountering, for example, deceased relatives in dreams, having various experiences, apparitions of the dead, etc., that they began to think there may be a duplicate or a secondary thing. And then when we go into the Greek civilization, we see that actually gradually with time that the Greek philosophers became interested in essentially what is the human mind, what are the psychological capabilities of human beings, why do we have thoughts, why do we have feelings, why do we have emotions, and where do they come to be, why do we have a sense of ethics and morality. A lot of the questions that we have today were essentially first addressed during that civilization, and at that time, they called this entity the psyche, which was later translated into the soul in English. And so actually, it's interesting because if you go into a room of, say, you know, I would say 1,000 doctors, and you said to them, do you believe in the psyche? They would all say, yes, of course, I believe in the psyche. If you then say to them, do you believe in the soul? Or in fact, other people in the public, if you ask them, do you believe in the soul? You'll find that that depends on their religious upbringing. So some will say, yes, of course. Some will say, no. Some will say, I'm not sure. But actually, when we realize, if we go back, the psyche and the soul were essentially the same thing. And in fact, at that time, many of the philosophers believed that the psyche or the soul was something that didn't exist after death. For example, Aristotle believed that the psyche or the soul was a product of the body, and that when the body died, the psyche or the soul also died. Whereas Plato, of course, believed that the psyche or the soul was eternal and came, was in existence before the body, and also continued to exist after death. And so essentially, if we then track through the history of Western philosophy and through scientific models, we see that essentially these two differing views have continued. In other words, Plato's view that the soul or psyche continues after death, and Aristotle's view that essentially the soul or psyche is nothing more than bodily processes, and therefore it dies after death. And now, today, the more commonly perceived scientific view is that essentially the psyche or the soul is produced by the body, but it actually dies after the body dies as well. So that's essentially what I understand of the term soul, and I think the idea of a ghost and stuff is more sort of cultural, shall we say. I'm not sure what we mean by that, but I think what is important for us to realize is that the soul is, at least in the true definition of it, is nothing more than the psyche, and it is what we are. And that scientifically, we of course don't know which of those views is correct, but there are some scientists on either camp.
Though you've dealt with near-death experiences, there are some doctors and nurses who have been at the bedside of people who have died and not come back, and they have seen the mist leave the body, the ectoplasm just simply poof away. And I find that to be fascinating, doctor, don't you?
I don't know. What do you mean by that, the ectoplasm?
Well, like the soul. They see something leave the body upon death.
I have to be honest with you, I haven't come across that. And I think that one of the things, for example, that I've been asked many, many times is, you know, there was this report that people who die suddenly weigh 21 grams less than they used to, and it's thought to be that this is related to the soul leaving the body, etc. And I think that's very difficult to, these kind of things are very difficult to prove. I'm sure that there are individuals who, because of their own beliefs, maybe think that way. But actually, as I've tried to point out, what's becoming fascinating for us scientifically is that we don't even know when this moment of death really is, because as I said, we know that after someone's died, for the first hour or two after they've died, their mind or consciousness hasn't disappeared. And so it's difficult to then say that, you know, something moved away. For example, people commonly say, you know, the last breath is when someone dies and that's when something changes. Well, these are old-fashioned ways of thinking of death, more Victorian era concepts of life and death, which is that death was a moment. Through resuscitation science, what we realize is that death is no longer a moment, it's just a process, and that we can track it down the first hour or two, and we can determine that the mind or consciousness, or what you may call the psyche or the soul, doesn't seem to become non-existent, doesn't seem to disappear, it seems to still be in existence. And so I don't know, it's hard for me to quantify those kinds of reports, but I know that they're out there, of course.
Let's take a few calls while we continue talking with you, Sam. Sylvia in Eagle Rock, California on the wild card line. Hi, Sylvia. Go ahead.
Hello, George. Happy New Year.
You too.
Hello, doctor.
Hi.
Hi. I just want to wonder if you've had any reports that compare. I had like an out-of-body near-death experience. I'm not sure which, but it was in 85. And what happened was I guess I just passed out in the backyard, and I was probably about 18. And I'm 42 now, and I was taken up, it felt like, into the universe, and shown the universe, and the earth was far away, and it was almost at a standstill where it was like past, present, and future seemed to be happening at once, like time standstill almost, or, and then it was just a magical experience, and the earth was glowing with a yellow, which was a feeling of deep sorrow, and suddenly I was in this like nebula cloud, which was sparkly, like beautiful. Nebula is all I can describe it as, and it was a being. It was like a, you know, a good being of light, I guess, comforting me in my thoughts that spiritually I would be okay, and many things like that. And as it was finishing, we came towards, diving down towards the earth really fast, and I saw like golden like walls that divide the earth, I guess, and they melted down, like dividing walls were melting, mm-hmm. And we dove right into the mouth of somebody that I don't know, and then just before this I looked to see what was holding me, and I was under the wing of a giant white dove. And we dove into the mouth of somebody, a lady, and I woke up back on the ground.
Well, that's quite an experience. Now, I don't know how you would relate that, Sam, to anything that you've studied. Do people come back with bizarre stories, Sam?
Mostly those who have, at least, as I said, when we study people who have had a cardiac arrest and who've objectively died. So thankfully, it sounds like, you know, Sylvia hadn't died, thankfully. But the people that we do study who've really died and been brought back to life again, they seem to have fairly consistent experiences, which are typical of the sort of near-death type of things that we discussed before. Rarely, though, as you appreciate, you know, these people are very ill for very different reasons.
Yeah.
For example, I remember one person who had survived a cardiac arrest who told me that he saw people jumping off a mountain. So I think, you know, one of the things that we try to do is to be sort of clear and objective, and that we're just trying to study what is the human experience after they've died. And what was interesting to me was that the vast majority, other than this one case that I mentioned to you, almost everyone else that I've seen who had any experiences, it was consistent with Raymond Moody's account of a near-death experience. So it seems to be fairly universal. But what seems to also be true about this experience, and the lady's experience reminded me of that, is that it does share some features with a deep mystical experience, however way you want to define that. And so people can be transformed in a positive way by having a deep religious or a mystical experience. And at least the near-death experience seems to have some of those features too. And furthermore, although having an out-of-body experience is one of the features of being close to death or having a near-death experience, it can also occur in various other circumstances too. In fact, many polls have demonstrated, both in the U.S. and the U.K., that up to 10% of the population have had an out-of-body experience at some point in their lives. And in many cases, they weren't even close to death. For example, it could have been a whole host of different stimuli, such as intense pain, even deep relaxation that can cause people to have this sensation of separating from themselves and seeing things from above. So I think it's something that is, you know, it's a fascinating experience to study. It does occur when people die, but it can also occur in other circumstances too.
I've always wondered too, Doctor, if death might merely be being in the dream state for all eternity. I just always wonder, is that possible? What do you think?
Well, I think that we are essentially thinking conscious beings, and we are our consciousness. We are that psyche. We are that, even if you think of it in a materialistic concept of the soul, that, you know, as Aristotle did, that it's from the body. But we are that entity, you know. And even our dreams are mediated by our psyche, our soul, our mind, our consciousness, however way you want to define that. And of course, since that is what we are, the big question is what happens to that entity after we cross over into the boundary of from life into what we perceive as being death biologically. And what, as I said, seems to be true is that at least that entity continues to exist in the early part of the dying process in death itself. And so, of course, what we experience may have similarities to being in a dream, because a dream is also still a part of our consciousness and our mind and psyche. So these are all fascinating questions, and I think I don't have all the answers because I'm limited in my own scientific abilities today. But I think what's fascinating is that we, for the first time in the history of humankind, have crossed over that boundary that had seemed forever static and impossible, and we're beginning to find fascinating insights into that entity of human mind and consciousness into the process of death.
Let's go to Lafayette, Indiana, east of the Rockies. Randy's up with us. Hey, Randy, good morning.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Dr. Parnia. I was wondering what your research has shown, or if you have ever looked at the differences in experiences people have when death occurs naturally as opposed to a suicide attempt.
Well, the research in that is fairly limited. So I can only describe, in this case, really my own experiences with people who have had suicide attempts. Obviously, one of the limitations is that people who die and don't come back again, whether it's suicide or natural causes, we don't get to speak to them. But there are many people that I have interviewed who had suicide attempts and who were, thankfully, revived and hadn't been allowed to die. And, of course, many people who had died naturally and then were revived and brought back to life again. Generally, what I found is that in many cases, people who had attempted suicides had very unpleasant experiences. I don't know why that was, but they definitely didn't seem to have the same experiences that some of the patients that I had interviewed who died of natural causes. That's why I always say, although for the majority of people who've died through natural causes, death does, at the very least, putting aside the debate about what, you know, is there something after life or not, that at least what we can conclude is that death is not an unpleasant experience and it's something that we shouldn't be afraid of, as people themselves who've had near-death experiences have told us. But nevertheless, for the subgroup of people who've attempted suicide, I think it can be very, very unpleasant. And therefore, I strongly always suggest that people don't think about that as an alternative. But so they are two different groups as far as I've studied them.
Let's go to Jim, truck driving in Maine. You're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hey, Jim, go ahead.
Hey, George, how you doing? How you doing?
Good.
Hi.
As well.
Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah. You know, when Christ was transfigured, I'll give you a biblical view and just see what you think. When he was transfigured on the mount, he turned into a being of light, and then they were confounded about that. So I think what happens, and I wonder what you think about this, is, you know, the Bible says that he is light, and in him there is no darkness. It also says that we're already dead in our trespasses and sins. So I think what happens, and maybe you can give me your thoughts on this, is that when we die, and even in the near-death experience, when people come back, the first thing they're going to see is this being of light, and they probably can't make it out. Sorry, my voice is a little rough, but I'm just curious what you think about that. Do you think that this could be God? I think that actually, after we leave, that's more of a reality than what we have here in this short little vapor of a life. What do you think about that, Doc?
Well, I think, you know, these are questions that people have been talking about for thousands of years, even going back to Greek times, because unfortunately, whether we like it or not, although it seems very real to us, our life is very temporary, and I'm definitely aware of that. I'm an intensive care doctor. I deal with life and death on a daily basis, and I see that in people, and I know it's going to happen to me one day, and, you know, 70, 80, 100 years may seem long to us, but if you look at the history of humankind, of course, my life is going to be insignificant compared to the length of time that humans have been around. So it is transient, and that's why it's important to find out what really happens when we die. In terms of meeting the being of light, as I said, it is something that has been described by people, and it does profoundly affect them. And sometimes the interpretation of what people see depends on their own background. So people who have a strongly Christian background may interpret that as having been Christ, but others may say, I just saw a being of light, I don't know who it was. And others may say that they saw, Hindus may say they saw a Hindu deity. Muslims may say that they saw one of their own saints that they believe in. So the interpretation seems to be dependent on what the individuals believe themselves, but they seem to all see, or many of them see, a being that's full of love, compassion, and guides them through this experience.
And it would lead you to believe that if there are near-death experiences and they're happening, what causes it? And then, of course, you have to bring in spirituality. We'll be back with more with Dr. Sam Parnia on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we'll take more of your final phone calls with Dr. Sam Parnia here, and we're talking about his work, what happens when we die. On our next Coast to Coast show, by the way, the remote viewer, Ed Dames, joins us as we talk about some of his work and what's happening with his Matrix Intelligence Agency. Doctor, a little strange facet of near-death experiences with Dr. Raymond Moody and Dr. PMH Atwater. They've worked on what they have called shared death experiences, where that person didn't die, but they were so close in proximity to a dying loved one that they experienced a portion of the dying person's near-death experience. Have you come across any of that?
I haven't personally come up with the people that I've interviewed haven't had this shared experience, I must say. But I have come across them anecdotally from other researchers. Also, my colleague in England, Dr. Peter Fenwick, has studied this in more detail. And there definitely seems to be a trend where, at least anecdotally, where there seems to be some shared elements of an experience of someone who's dying by people who are close to them. I haven't studied it in more detail other than that.
How strange is that? Now, your book came out in 2006, What Happens When We Die. Is it still available for people?
It is still available. Yes, you're right. It came out a few years ago, so there's been a lot of updates since that time. But it was something that I was interested in sharing with people at the time.
All right, great. And the awareness study, started in 2008. It's 25 major medical centers across the UK, the USA, Austria. It's all over the place. When will you wrap it up?
Well, essentially, when I got involved in this field, as I mentioned, when we first started speaking, I found that there was a lot of sort of theories associated with, say, the scientific views about this. And my intention for writing the book was try to at least lay the foundations, essentially, with where I was with this research, which was to determine what are the theories, what's the evidence for them. In other words, the theory that this is some sort of brain-based process, it's a hallucination, it's a psychological phenomenon, or that it may be very real. And to try to demonstrate, in my opinion at that time, how we could do research in this field. And one of the areas that I think was very important was to try to objectively determine whether out-of-body experiences were real or not. Because the rest of the experience, as fascinating as it is, we cannot prove or disprove it scientifically. For example, we highlighted a lot about people's experiences and their encounters with a being of light. But although it is incredible and it does transform the individual, it's impossible to prove or disprove scientifically. Whereas when a patient comes and tells doctors what they were doing in precise detail, then that we could verify. So what we have been trying to do since that time is essentially to verify these. And one element is to place hidden images in resuscitation areas such that they can only be seen if a patient is looking from above. And so my first book essentially summarized the field up to that point. And also, in fairness, I wanted to make people aware of how difficult it is to do this kind of research, because even though I tried for more than 10 years to get funding to do a multi-center study, it seemed impossible at one point. Until eventually in 2008, we managed to get collaboration from over 25 major medical centers in the UK and the US and one in Austria to do this research. And we launched the AWARE study at a symposium that was sponsored by the Knorr Foundation and the United Nations itself. And we actually announced it at the United Nations. And it's been going very well. And what's been incredible to me is that we've had so much support. And when we approach other hospitals, many of them want to get involved with this proposal.
Great.
Now, everyone's waiting for these results. And unfortunately, it's very difficult to announce them because we're looking at over 1,000 patients who've had a cardiac arrest and survived in the participating hospitals. We estimate that we should have about 30 or 40 out-of-body experiences. And of those, we're all, of course, all waiting to see if they do see the pictures or not. We hope to be able to release the first set of this data in about 12 to 18 months from now, probably more realistically 18 months. But it really is an ongoing research project because we're all trying to investigate what happens when we die, because not only will it have implications for the medical research and medical care of patients, in other words, trying to make sure that those who are brought back to life don't have brain damage and can survive better, but also is inadvertently helping us to answer some of our deepest philosophical questions. In other words, we've talked about earlier in this program, what does happen when we die? Does anything remain? If so, for how long? And what is the nature of the human mind and consciousness? What is the psyche? What is the soul that people have talked about for thousands of years? But for the first time, we can scientifically research these, and that's part of our endeavor as well. So hopefully, every few years we'll have new results and we'll be able to share that with the public.
Okay, let's go to Jim in Whittam, Minnesota. There you go, Jim, first-time caller. Hi.
How you doing, George and Dr. Sam? Yeah, I live in a little town called Windham, Minnesota. And I'm a new caller, so I don't know exactly
Just ask your question. Go ahead.
Just one or all of them at once?
Well, we'll see how long it takes. Go ahead.
Okay. What I wanted to ask Dr. Sam was, by the way, hi, doctor.
Hi.
I died from cardiac arrest a little 13 months ago. I died at St. Mary's Hospital in Rochester, Minnesota. That's actually the pretty world-famous Mayo Clinic.
Yes.
So I was gone in Earth time for 5 minutes. I actually died three times. They kept doing CPR on me. They couldn't bring me back. The last time that, and by the way, I wanted to tell you this. I don't know if anybody's ever said this to you. I could feel myself take my last breath, even though I was under anesthesia, because it, during that point, when it was the third time that I had went, they were doing CPR, is when actually two angels came to me, and they were with me to help me, as they called it, prepare for my journey.
How do you know they were angels, Jim?
They said they were angels of the Lord, and I had no reason not to believe that. But what I want to ask the doctor first is, why do they call it a near-death experience when you really do, in fact, die?
Well, the reason why actually you've brought up an interesting point. The reason why it was called a near-death experience was because when it was first described by Dr. Raymond Moody in 1975 in his book Life After Life, he had collected cases of people who he believed had come close to death for various reasons, and that, according to his definition, would have potentially died if there had been no medical intervention. Now, that's a very loose term, and that's why, you know, it was called near-death experiences, and it's led to a lot of debate. I actually no longer call it a near-death experience. I just use that term for because people are aware of it. But patients that I study, I call it an actual death experience because they really have died. Okay. And what we're studying is what people experience in an objective period of clinical death, no longer near-death, no longer vague, but very precise. And so in those people, it is an actual death experience.
Okay. And you know, another thing, when I heard George say something a few minutes ago about, I think it was George or somebody, maybe it was one of your callers, said they, when a person died, the nurses or doctors, you know, saw something leave their body or
the mist. Yeah, I was asking him about the mist.
Mist. Yeah, the reason I was asking you that is when I died, the chief cardiologist told my wife, I was in a 12-day coma, and they had me on full life support. The doctor actually had told my wife after this 9-hour surgery, triple bypass, that she said, I'm sorry to tell you this, but your husband is probably not going to live more than 6 hours.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that should only take, 3 to 4 hours for the surgery?
Yeah, and I think what happened, George, was they had, after I went into cardiac arrest, I had internal bleeding, and they said that this infection, they couldn't stabilize me. So I'm pretty sure, from what my wife tells me, that they induced this coma that I was in for 12 days.
They do that, yeah.
And kept me on life support because they couldn't. And I don't quite understand that, doctor, so maybe you could explain part of that to me. Why would they put me in an induced coma if they can't stabilize me? Was that just to keep me alive?
I think what happens, because they just did this to a friend of mine last year, if you're awake and you have to be on life support, I think the body tries to fight that. Is that not the case, Sam?
That's absolutely correct, yes. Yeah. It's when they put your breathing tube down your throat and put you on a life support machine, on a ventilator, then you'll be fighting that, of course, as you'd imagine. And therefore, in order to ensure patient safety and actually their well-being, patients are put into a relative coma with drugs, a bit like sleeping pills, so you can just sleep through it and not be uncomfortable while they try to treat and heal your body. And that's what it sounds like they did. And, of course, having a cardiac arrest has a significant impact on the whole body, and they probably cooled your brain. That now the standard of practice is to cool people down to 32 to 34 degrees Celsius in order to preserve the brain and ensure that patients recover better. So it sounds like they did a great job because you're here talking to us now.
Doctor, what has been for you one of the strangest stories you've ever heard from some of these people who've experienced this?
I can't recall it necessarily a strange experience as such. I'm just trying to think, as you mentioned, as you asked me this question. But I think the most profound, at least I'll start with that, the most profound experiences that I've come across are children. I've come across at least two children who had near-death experiences, but really they were very, very young. One of them hadn't, in fact, when he had the event, his heart stopped, and he wasn't even 3 years old.
Oh.
And his parents noticed that, so what happened was he had a seizure, he had epilepsy. And in some cases, the seizure can actually cause your heart to stop. So this child's heart stopped. And they called the paramedics who came and resuscitated him, did chest compressions, etc. And thankfully got him back, took him to the hospital where he was taken to the intensive care unit. And then eventually when he came home, and as he was growing older, his parents noticed that he kept on drawing the same theme. And he drew essentially, you know, the ability of a young child, you know, like a matchstick man, but it was connected with a, it looked like basically a line and then a round thing and at the top of the head. But even though his sister kept on drawing different things, this child kept on drawing the same thing. And as the child grew older, the drawing got more complex, but it was the same theme. And then eventually in the course of play, he started telling his parents and grandparents about what happened when he had died. In his own words. And when they asked him what this picture was, he said, oh, when you die, you see a bright lamp, and you're connected by a cord to it. And so what he was drawing, that round thing above his head, was the lamp, and the line was this cord. And for me, this whole experience was fascinating, because this child hadn't been... I later interviewed the child, and he drew a picture for me of his out-of-body experience in an ambulance. And he remembered how the buckle had come undone in the ambulance seat when they were taking him to the hospital. And for me, it was incredible because here was a small child who knew, had no concept of life or death, let alone heaven or hell or any concept of a near-death type of experience. Yet his experience was very similar to an adult, except that he was expressing it in the terminology of a small child. And this was very significant because people had argued up to that point, and I think rightly so, that maybe these experiences are based upon people's previous backgrounds because they believe in a heaven or a hell or a near-death experience. That's what they're able to recall. But, of course, small children don't have that. And I've come across others, and I'm completely flabbergasted. I'm completely astonished by the accuracy of what these children say and the detail that they can describe. So it is incredible.
Lou from Gardenville, Nevada, would like to know why some of the people just don't remember the experience. What do you think's going on with them?
Well, this is a question that's really fascinated all of us for a long time. Is it that only 10 or 20% of people have these experiences, or is it that more or everyone has the experience and a small proportion can recall them? My own interpretation, based upon the work that I've done, is that probably everyone has the experience. But in the same way that we all dream, and there's a breakdown in the mind-brain or mind-body interface, and therefore we can't recall all our dreams. But we know that everyone dreams every night, and in fact we only recall a small proportion of them. Somehow, some people can recall the experience while others can't. And the reason I think that is because a number of studies, a number of observations that I've made myself. First of all, if you look at near-death experiences, there are 15 or 16 main features that have been described, and we went through those earlier. What's interesting, though, is that when you study patients, nobody has all of those features, but some people have some or group of them. And it may be that they've had more, but they've forgotten details. And what we found is that when we interview patients after a cardiac arrest, if you get to them immediately when they become conscious, they remember more. But if you then interview them a day or two later, they remember less of the features that they had had. And so that supports the idea that perhaps many more people would have recalled more if we'd managed to get to them immediately. But because they're recalling their experiences days later, they started to forget elements of it, which would then support the idea that perhaps maybe even everyone had had the experience. And the other thing that I think supports it is some studies, small, that have suggested that people who can recall their near-death experiences, they may be wired, their brain may be wired in a way that is perhaps more resilient and able to recall it. Because again, if you think about it, these patients have gone through a very serious incident where mm-hmm. there was no blood flow to the brain at all. And all our research demonstrates the brain shuts down. It stops functioning during a cardiac arrest, during death, because of that. And so no one should have any recollections. But it may be that their brain is more resilient and therefore able to recall their experiences in the same way that you might argue some people are wired such that they are able to recall their dreams more than most of us. You know, they just, that's the way they are. So that's my view about it. We need more research, though.
I think so. Brenda is in Palm Coast, Florida. Hi, Brenda. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I just was wanting to share an experience with you about my son that passed away back in 2000. I had adopted him as a teenager. His biological mother had died when he was 6 years old. As he was, we were in the hospital, he was dying. He kept looking over in the corner and saying, "Is that you, Mommy? Is that you, Mommy?" And the nurses were like, "He's talking to you." I said, "No, he's never called me Mommy. He's talking to his mother. He died when he was little." And you know, I tried to get him to go to church and stuff, and he says, "You know, if there's a God, I'll take it up with him when I see him," you know, kind of a deal.
Yeah.
And as he's dying, he's laying there, and he kept pulling his arms away from whatever was there, and he says, "I'm not ready yet. Be quiet. I need to think. Quit talking to me. I'm trying to think." And he kept doing that, and he'd hit himself in the head, and he'd say, "I'm telling you, be quiet. I've got to think," and there was nobody talking in the room. And then he looked over at me, and he started screaming, and he started screaming at me. He says, "Mom, what kind of a mother are you? Help me, help me." And I said, "What do you need?" And he says, "Can you see these flames are burning my bed, and they're burning my feet? Get the fire extinguisher. Call the fire department. Something. Help me."
Jeez.
And I went out, and I got the nurses, and they came back in, and they sedated him, and he died a few hours later.
Oh, my God. Now, would you say in that particular case, Sam, that he was having some kind of hallucination?
It's possible. It's certainly possible. Obviously, from what you know you've described over the phone, you know he wasn't dying at that moment. He, you know, I'm sorry. My condolences. I'm sorry he passed away. But it was a few hours later. And of course, people who have any imbalance in their bodily processes do tend to have hallucinations. And so it may well have been. I don't know if that was necessarily. It doesn't sound like a near-death experience to me.
What a remarkable story, though.
Yes.
Sam, stay with us. Another final hour to go with your phone calls with Dr. Sam Parnia as we talk about what happens when we die. I'm George Norrie, and we'll be back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.